Tonight on Arena, we remember the poet Paul Durkin and R.M. Kavanagh, also known as Rasher, on his new exhibition, Don't Anger the Gods. is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Well, indeed, it was sad news that we got over the weekend when the death was announced of Paul Durkin. Tributes have been paid to this unique, inimitable, witty, eccentric and charming man who was not only one of our most popular poets, but he traced his lineage back to the heroes of the Easter Rising. He was also able to run a cool, appraising eye over the modern world and what makes us quintessentially human and quintessentially Irish. One of his friends is the poet Thomas McCarthy, who joins me now from our Cork studio. Thank you so much for being with us this evening, Thomas. A sad day, I think a sad weekend, really, for all of us, but particularly for you. You've known him quite a long time. How are you feeling and coming to terms with the death of your friend?
I'm feeling sad that he is gone, but to be honest with you, I'm also feeling, in a funny way, elated that he has now collected himself, that he is now, he becomes his poems, and that's how we will know him into the future. So that is reassuring, because his poems are absolutely profound. They're just wonderful things.
It is an extraordinary body of work that he has left with us. But talk to me, if you would, Thomas, about when you and he first met. You were both young men at the time.
Well, he was slightly older than me. He was 10 years older, actually. But he was actually just finishing up his degree course in UCC, where I had gone. And he really, his great love was archaeology. He loved archaeology. I mean, he loved Michael O'Kelly, Professor O'Kelly of the Archaeology Department. And I think the feeling was mutual, certainly in the beginning. And he in fact, for a while, I think, became a tutor in the Archaeology Department. And you know what? He could have been a fantastic archaeologist. I mean, his enthusiasm for O'Kelly's excavations at Newgrange and Ogan's great excavations at Knowth, he knew everything about them and he loved talking about them. So he was a great kind of intellectual who loved digging up things, you know, but he had this other life, which was the life of the poet.
Yeah, and obviously he dug up a lot within the poems. There is no doubt about that. Was the poetry, was that writing going on through his time in archaeological studies?
And, it was. And indeed, Westport in the Light of Asia Minor had already come out. He was known and recognised as the poet Paul Durkin, as Seamus Heaney always referred to him, Poet Durkin. He's always recognised as that, you know.
Yeah, and the humour that he had in his poems is one of the things that struck me as I was looking back over some of them today, and indeed listening back to a programme that we did on the occasion of the publication of Paul Durkin at 80 just a few months back, and it's still up there online if you want to get a chance to listen to it. Colm Tobin, Dermot Bulger and Paula Meehan were with me in studio on that night. But what really struck me looking at the poems is how and Colm Tobin pointed this out to me on the night, how hilariously funny these poems are, but how deadly serious they are at the same time.
Absolutely. That was his gift, really. Like, he lived a very kind of monk-like existence in his large house in Lower Montanati in Cork, upstairs when I knew him, and he kind of retreated to that upstairs room looking down over the city. But he had a keen sense of society, you know, which is probably, he almost had that MacBride blood in him, you know, which is, makes people
aristocratic.
Yeah, exactly. And attractive and demanding. So he had a dramatic personality, you see, demanding space, demanding the stage and commanding that stage when he got it. Rather like Micheál MacLiamore, you know.
Yeah, I saw where you had mentioned how he moved like an actor. And for me, he was one of, like, he was a poet who really could read his own work. There are very few other people who can read his work in the way that he read it. There's an inverted commas, a deadpan quality to his delivery, but there's always a kind of a mischief in behind that deadpan delivery.
Oh, there's always a plot. There's always mischief in him. I mean, when Paul Durkin entered a room, the plot thickened. Even even if there was no plot, it thickened. And like that was his life. That was how he had impeccable good breeding, as my sister used to say. He was kind of the Richard Burton of Irish poetry, my sister Mary used to say in the 80s. His complexity and social grace and the impeccable breeding in his manners all made a very attractive kind of person, you know, and people were drawn to him in a very particular way, you know.
I think Thomas, it would be remiss of me not to let people hear some of that brilliant voice and that brilliant delivery. How would you introduce, because there's a kind of a humour in this and a great sadness in Kilfenora Teaboy.
Oh, yeah. He's very aware always. Underlying is that acute sense of the loneliness of people and their isolation. And he knew that from his own battle with addiction throughout his life, how lonely the fight against addiction is. And so he gravitated towards lonely and isolated characters because of that.
Well, let's listen to him read then his great poem, Kilfenora Teaboy.
I'm the Kilfenora Teaboy, and I'm not so very young. But though the land is going to pieces, I will not take up the gun. I am happy making tea. I make lots of it when I can. And when I can't, I just make do. And I do a small bit of sheep farming on the side. It's the small bit of furs between two towns is what makes the Kilfenora Teaboy really run. I have 9 healthy daughters, and please God, I will have more. Sometimes my dear wife beats me, but on the whole, she's a gentle soul. When I'm not making her some tea, I sit out and watch them all ring a rosying in the street. And I do a small bit of sheep farming on the side. It's the small bit of furs between two towns is what makes the Kilfenora Teaboy really run. Oh, indeed, my wife is handsome. She has a fire lighting in each eye. You can pluck laughter from her elbows and from her knees, poor money's tears. I make all my tea for her. I'm her tea boy on the hill. And I also thatch her roof. And I do a small bit of sheep farming on the side. It's the small bit of furs between two towns is what makes the Kilfenora Teaboy really run. But I'm not only a famous teaboy, I'm a famous caveman too. I paint pictures by the hundred, but you can't sell walls. Although the people praise my pictures, as well as my turf-perfumed blend, they rarely fling a fiver in my face. Don't we do an awful lot of dying on the side? That's the small bit of furs between two towns is what makes the Kilfenora Teaboy really run.
Kilfenora Teaboy, read there by Paul Dorcan, and his friend and fellow poet Thomas McCarthy is with me this evening on Arena, celebrating the poet that was Paul Dorcan, but as you say, Thomas, the poet that is and will be in those those poems of his that will live on for a very long time indeed. It struck me how much of a poet of, you know, that poem that we got there, yes, it's a kind of a fictional character that we're imagining, but we can see lots of people within that Kilfenora Teaboy. Yeah. But one of the things that Paul Dorcan did was certainly in his poems and in the period he was writing in the latter part of the 20th century, his commentary on Irish society was very, very acute and very observant.
It was, and I think part of that must have been the kind of inheritance from the MacBrides, you know, from Maud Gonne, and from Sean MacBride, his godfather, that sense of public duty, that literature is also a public duty, particularly a poet's life is a public duty. He had that, and I was always teasing him he saw me always, as a Fianna Fáiler, and he would tease me all the time about conservatism in the rural Ireland and things like this. And I mean, he had so many enthusiasms. He was enthusiastic about Michael Hartnett. He was enthusiastic about colour television. He was for a while enthusiastic about Russia, the love he found in the writings of Anthony Cronin. He was enthusiastic about Michael Hartnett especially. You know, he idolised him. He was enthusiastic about Mary Robinson. And I used to tease him about Mary Robinson. I used to say, but Paul, Brian Lenihan got 80,000 more first preference votes than she did. And he'd say, you ignorant fellow, he'd say, the good cooperate. That's how the good win out, he said, and how change happens. So he was an astute person. He knew about politics. He understood it. And he knew exactly what he was doing.
Yeah, and you're saying he would slag you about the Fianna Fáil aspects. Yeah. I'm sure he would have slagged Fine Gaelers in exactly the same fashion. And
possibly.
Probably Labour TDs as well.
So he had a reason to be, at that moment, grateful to Fine Gael and Austin Curry.
Absolutely. And there is that quality within the poems. Even I was looking through some of the titles, which at times are almost read like newspaper headlines. There is this sense that he is reporting on the society that is unfolding in front of his eyes. And you've chosen a poem to read for us that he wrote very quickly after the death of Seamus Heaney.
Yeah, and it's called Breaking News. And it was written within hours of hearing about Seamus Heaney's death. I mean, it's hard to believe that it's 12 years ago now, nearly, in August, late August of that year. And Paul he was always listening to the radio. He loved television and radio, but radio especially, and radio news especially. But he's there making his fire because it's suddenly a chilly late August morning, and with his fire lighters and his briquettes, he's trying to make a fire. And then he says in his poem, Breaking News, he says, and down the chimney rustled Seamus's antiphonal derry brogue, undiluted by Harvard, Berkeley, Oxford, the BBC, Carisfort, RTE, Queens. Are you all right down there, Poet Durkin? That's how he always addressed me down 37 years, Poet Durkin. Calm down. I'm only dead. I'm only beginning the new life. Only hours and minutes into it. I miss my wife, my children, my grandchildren, my brothers, most of all my mighty spouse. Otherwise, I've become the spaceman I've always longed to be, in flight, breaking the sound barrier out in the cosmos.
That is an extraordinary piece of poetic writing to be done at any time and at any speed. But the speed with which Paul Durkin, Thomas McCarthy reading Paul Durkin's poem written in the hours, as you say, Thomas, after the death of Seamus Heaney. It's an extraordinary set of observations and so uplifting at a time when there was such sadness in this country and in the entire poetry community.
Well, he knew about the redemptive power of poems. That's why he loved Michael Hartnett, you know. I always remember meeting him in 79. It was in the November that Seamus Heaney published Fieldwork. And, you know, I was kind of upset because I met Michael Hartnett on the street in Cork, and he told me that he'd just taken a job as a night watchman with CMP Dairies. And Seamus Heaney had just finished his first semester at Harvard. And I thought it was kind of uneven. It was, you know, the rewards for poets can be so uneven. Mm. And I said this to Paul. Paul said, no, Thomas. To be a watchman of the night is so important. And I thought, there he was.
Yeah.
He wouldn't lose his enthusiasm or his sense of importance for Michael Hartnett, you know.
Yeah. Well, Thomas, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts on your friend and fellow poet Paul Durkin with us this evening here on Arena. That's Thomas McCarthy, and indeed remembering Paul Durkin, whose death was announced this weekend. What do François Mitterrand's forbidden final meal, Beethoven's immortal symphony, and the crunch of God's songbird beneath Anthony Bourdain's teeth have in common? Well, for Irish artist Rasher, also known as R.M. Kavanagh, they're all part of a fascinating, grotesque thread connecting death, beauty appetite and creation. In his latest exhibition, Don't Anger the Gods, the Wicklow-based artist celebrated for his emotionally charged portraits and explorations of the human condition, dives deep into this strange symphony of contradictions, as he's calling it, and invites viewers to join him at the Flux D2 Gallery on Dublin's Chatham Row from Thursday, May the 22nd. Delighted that Rasher or Mark or RM, and he says I can call him any one of the three, is with me in studio. It's good to have you here, Rasher, Mark,
RM. Pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. Yeah, I was undecided throughout the year of how to name myself. Rasher was a name where it was, I don't know, I was anointed with it when I was a child, when I was 5 or 6, because I was skinny, blonde hair and sunburnt. And then as you get older into the art industry, it just doesn't seem like, it doesn't sound like a Picasso or it's a bit of food. So I kind of struggled with it, and then I just started using the RM Kavanagh, Rasher Mark Kavanagh. Yeah. A bit more flavour to it.
Yeah. Oh, a bit more flavour to it. Look, look what you did there. You're a self-taught artist, Mark. How did the move towards art come about? Because I think it was a seminal moment in your life, in your teens.
Yeah, when look, I was always drawing and sketching as a child. I was a normal kid, just, you know, playing football and skateboarding and all that kind of stuff. But when I was a teenager, I got grounded for 3 months. I won't mention what I was up to because my kids would be listening. but that 3 months of solitude, I really focused on what I wanted to do. I was locked away in my bedroom and all I had was oil pastels and from my art pack from school. And then I just unleashed my creativity onto whatever I had. Yeah. It was this bedroom wall, art sketchbooks, and that was it. I just didn't stop then.
And trying to forge your way there, I'm kind of tempted. Can I say, let's just say that you weren't sticking pieces of paper together with the glue that you were holding in your hand. That's where you were grounded. Can we put it that way?
Yeah.
the route through into the art industry, as you called it there earlier on, the route from that to being, you know, a man who's exhibited in the Chateau Marmont in Los Angeles, who's been commissioned to paint a portrait of the late King Hussein of Jordan by his family. That's a big journey to have made from no formal art training.
Yeah, when you put all that together, I never would have thought I would have achieved that. Coming from a council estate in Bray, you don't know how to get from one end of the art industry to the other, because you don't even know how to get into the art industry, because nobody where I grew up was into art. There was no art in my family. Nobody went to college. And it was all like, the only thing I knew about art was cartoonist, being a cartoonist. And that's the route that I thought I wanted to do when I was 13. Mm. It's only when I started to learn about art history in secondary school from the art history books, like I was introduced to Caravaggio, Francis Bacon, Rembrandt, and then that opened up a whole new world for me. So then I just got obsessed with oil painting and painters. And then the only route I knew was to go to art college. So that's what I was trying to do. Yeah. But you needed 2 honours and 4 passes to go to art college. So that was the path I was on then.
And that didn't come to pass.
At
that time. What was the, you know, how secretive, in inverted commas, were you about this passion for art? As you say, there was nobody in your group of friends, I presume, who was doing anything like this. Did you feel you had to hide it, or were you more than happy to say, no, I'm interested in this stuff?
No, it was never really like when I was like early teenager, it was just, I just did art in a lot of my friends were into music and played in bands.
Yeah.
So I didn't need to hide it in that sense, because they were into music. But I played soccer, and all the lads who I played soccer with, they wouldn't have been into art. So you wouldn't really speak about art to the soccer cohort of people. But with all my friends in secondary school, yeah, we could talk about it.
You nattered away about it, so there was no stigma attached to what you were doing. Okay, let's talk a little bit about the new exhibition, Don't Anger the Gods. And I think we have to find out about the Ortolan bird. This little bird. So tell us about that bird and the awful, consumerism, and I'm trying to think, ritual around the killing and consumption of that bird.
It's illegal now to eat this little bird. It's a tiny little songbird, and I first came across it, and I was watching this program called Billions, and in one of the scenes they were eating this little bird with napkins on their head, and I got very curious about it, and then I did a deep dive and I started to research, you know, eating a delicacy under a napkin.
Yeah.
And then what I found out was that this little bird is caught on a lime stick. Poachers would catch them. They put a lot of glue on a stick and they'd put it in a tree, and then they'd have, you know, a little speaker with a recording, and the mating call would attract the bird, and they'd get stuck onto the stick, and then he would try to free himself over a number of hours, pecking at his feet. He would get exhausted and then give up. The poachers would come along, take the bird, sell it to whatever restaurants are illegally serving this dish. But they put the bird into a dark cage because he's a nocturnal bird and he only eats at nighttime. So he would force feed himself once they put a little dark cloth over the cage. He would force feed himself on figs and grapes and nuts. And then after he's taken, or he's doubled in size or tripled in size, they take him out. They drown him in Armagnac, and then they pluck his feathers, chop his feet off, and his wings. And then they fry him in butter. And then they present it to the guests with napkins on the head. And the reasons they have napkins on their heads is to hide their shame from God, because they're eating one of God's songbirds. And it's to encase the aroma from all the flavours of the figs and grapes and the aroma. And it's also to hide your embarrassment from the other diners, from picking bones out of your teeth. But Anthony Bourdain, the TV, what do you call him, a celebrity chef, he described it as when you eat a bird whole, skull and all, you crunch down on the bones, and the bones and the rib cage would pierce the side of your cheeks. So then there'll be trickles of blood entering your mouth. So you've got iron mixed in with the flavour. So you've got all these nutty flavours, fat juices, and it's supposed to be one of the most.
Yeah, but as you describe it, it's a wonderful delicacy, but a pretty disgusting thing.
It's
that
torturous,
has to be done.
And for a little bird to go through that.
However, this little bird is no ordinary little bird. Let us have a listen to the song of this little bird and a very famous piece of music, which will immediately come afterwards. That is extraordinary, the song of this little ortolan bird, which is part of R.M. Kavanagh Rasher's exhibition, upcoming exhibition, Don't Anger the Gods. There it is. It quite definitely is the first three notes of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
I was shocked when I heard that, when I did the research and I found this little video on about the extinction of ortolan. And I was just fascinated. But Beethoven has put three birds in his symphonies, but this one, the Fifth Symphony, would be Beethoven's most famous symphony.
Of course, yeah.
And when I found out about, and I started to research Beethoven, he would, from his long day of 8 hours writing music, he would take long walks, you know, during his day, and he would absorb the sounds around him.
Of course.
So Beethoven was absorbing the frequencies around him. And I think it's quite obvious there in that clip that he used that, the bird's tweet, and put it
Absolutely.
Into the symphony.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the paintings that you have, which we'll tweet now, or we'll put up on our socials, which is at @RTE_arena on Insta, or at @RTE_arena on X, the muse, which has a picture of what looks to me as if it could be Beethoven in a wonderful blue coat. Tell us what's going on in this particular painting and the size of the painting, which I think is important.
Yeah, the muse is it's an oil on canvas, and it's 5 feet by 5 feet. And the inspiration behind this painting, I'll describe it for the listeners. Just it's kind of got mythical creatures in the background, and it has a little blue, kind of, I'd call her a guardian, in blue, and she's offering up, would be kind of nature's offerings. And I got this idea from Beethoven taking his walks in the woods, and I want to focus on what nature offers up to human beings, as in abundance, nature offers up all the sustenance that we need to survive. And what I'm trying to focus on here is that we have to protect nature, because in Ireland and in Greece, we have mythical stories to protect nature and the land around us. Like, we would have like the fairy forts or the fairy rings. And if you chop down the trees in the fairy fort, the fairy ring, you would get bad luck. So what I was trying to do is to basically describe to people and tell them that, like, you have to look after nature, and if you look after nature, will look after you.
Yeah, because there is another painting that stood out for me from, by the way, you brought me in the little card about the exhibition itself, and a part of the Beethoven painting is on that, and it made me really want to see it in its full feet by 5 feet glory. But there was another piece that really struck me, which is The Universe Is In Me, which is this idea of Mother Earth. You really are talking about how we are consuming the planet, and the Ortolan bird is a perfect example of that, brought to an extreme, but how we're consuming the planet and not taking care of it.
Yeah, it's you see, the flip side of the exhibition is that, you know, one man will take nature and create a masterpiece, but then another man will take nature and torture it for its own grotesque pleasure and eat it. So that's what I'm trying to you know, focus on, is that, like, we can treat our planet with respect and you know, it would look after us. But the painting, The Universe, Universe is In Me, is a portrait of, it is my mother when she was 21. It was a black and white photograph of my mom, my dad. And as a mother figure, I see as Mother Earth. And I have like a hole in the middle of it. But what I'm trying to get across here is that within the chaos of the cosmos and the galaxy, abstraction would have came first before we were, first structure was formed. So within this portrait, it's basically nebula and galaxies exploding in chaos and destruction. But out of that destruction will form and shape and new evolution, a new creation. So that's what that painting is.
One final question. I mean, I don't have a chance to get into Smoke on the Water and how that's Beethoven's Fifth Symphony backwards. Yeah. But one thing I do want to ask you about, given your background and where you've come from in terms of this self-taught artist, how difficult was it during all these years that you have been working as an artist? How difficult was it to literally make ends meet and continue to work as a professional artist?
I never knew anything about, like, you know, the financial, you know, elements of being an artist. I was just doing it because I love doing it. But I remember when I was 19, 20, and that's when the Celtic Steiger was kind of starting to kind of roar, and people were saying, oh, it's a good time to be an artist because there's loads of money around. And it didn't really, because I was so young, it didn't really resonate with me. And then, like, when I brought paintings into a gallery, if we can tell you the story briefly.
Yeah.
How much time have I got?
About 30 seconds.
Okay. No, that's too long. But when I brought paintings into the gallery, they didn't want to take them in, but I just said, look, just leave them there. And if they sell, I'll take whatever money. I think I sold them for 50 quid. But at the time, like, it was a good time to start being an artist. But then when the recession hit, like,
it was not a good time.
And it wasn't a good time. So I've been, I had the highs and the very, very lows.
Yeah.
So
I suppose, like many walks of life, a recession is a recession. And there's no easy way through it. Great to see you, Mark. Thanks so much for coming in to me this evening. That's Mark R.M. Kavanagh, Rasher, better known to many of us, I think, by that name. His latest exhibition, Don't Anger the Gods, opens this Thursday, May the 22nd, at Flux 22 Gallery in Chatham Row. And for those of you who are trying to, it's beside Neary's Pub, what used to be the old College of Music on TU Dublin, that's where the Flux 22 Gallery is. And you'll find full details on Rasher's Insta account, which is at Rasher Mark Kavanagh. You're listening to Monday Night's Arena. Furtiva Lagrima from the mouth of Luciano Pavarotti, one of the best known and perhaps most loved arias from Donizetti's L'Elisir d'Amore, or The Elixir of Love, the two-act comedy from 1832. That is getting a new production from Irish National Opera. Soprano Claudia Boyle plays the part of Adina, a wealthy young woman with two suitors to choose from, the faithful Nemorino, who sings the aria that we just heard, and the swaggering Sergeant Balcore. I'm presuming you say the E at the end of that. Nemorino, fearing that he has only love, no money to offer her, enlists the help of a quack doctor with, of course, the aforementioned Elixir of Love. Cal McChrystal directs the production with Irina Yashima as conductor. And delighted that Cal and Claudia are with me in studio this evening. And as we were playing that, Claudia Boyle, you told me something about Una Furtiva Lagrima that I did not know. Because you think Elixir of Love, you're going to think Una Furtiva Lagrima. But?
But it's, it was actually a later insert when Donizetti originally wrote the opera. He just made a couple of changes and decided to add the most popular piece in the whole opera, Una Furtiva Lagrima.
So it nearly wasn't there.
It was meant to be, obviously.
It certainly wasn't. It was meant to be. We'll come back to Adina and the story of Elixir in a minute. But sitting beside you is Cal McChrystal. I was very interested, Cal, when I looked at your CV. I noticed the word comedy appearing quite a lot, a comedy consultant on certain film works. Was it the director of comedy at the National Theatre in Great Britain that you were? Is that the correct title there?
Yes. I mean, I work across film and television and theatre and opera and circus as well. And the thing that brings everything together is that I just do comedy stuff. And this is my sixth opera, the comedy consultant credits I get would be on movies, because I work a lot on big movies as a comedy consultant.
Paddington being one of the biggest, I would guess.
Paddington, yeah. I've actually got quite a big footprint on that film, because I do a lot of the motion capture work for his facial expressions. So, and in fact, the scene in Paddington 1 in the bathroom, I did that whole thing on my first day. It was all improvised.
So this is the one where he's brushing his teeth, isn't it?
Brushing his teeth. He sticks the toothbrushes into his ears and puts his head down the toilet, everything. That was me just kind of going mad one morning.
And it's such an important and vital scene to that film itself. So a comedy consultant can play a very big role if it's the right comedy consultant.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm very proud of both those films. I've got a tiny little role in Paddington 2 as well. I'm one of his prisoner friends.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. I have to watch it with new eyes the next time we look
at
it, Claudia. And have you done the sticking the toothbrush in your ears part yet for Adina? Has Cal told you about that?
Not yet, but we have a host of gags, Sean. It's a very, very funny show, and we really, really enjoyed. I certainly have enjoyed working with Cal. He just makes it. I mean, you say funny stuff, but it's not. I mean, it's an art. I mean, he's just making this show just alive. It's so charming, and we've really, really enjoyed. And I think when you enjoy the process, well, then the result is going to hopefully be enjoyable.
Yeah, you would hope so. Just to get a sense of the opera, I mean, when you listen to Una Furtiva Lagrima, as we just heard it there, you think, are there any laughs, or is anybody crying during this opera all the time? Because poor Al Nemorino is heartbroken at the thought that he won't get Adina's love.
Yeah, but actually, I mean, that specific aria, he's obviously he has bought a love potion in the hope of winning her. But it comes near the end of the opera, the end of Act Two, and he thinks he has seen what looks like a tear coming down her face and in the previous scene. And it's just a lovely moment. He's by himself. And, you know, we know he loves her, but it's really at this moment that you know it's completely genuine. Yeah. He is opening up his soul. He is bearing his soul with the love and basking in the hope that she might love him too.
I think you will get a few tears at that moment. Yeah. I mean, most of it is just really hilariously funny. And it's all set in the Wild West, this production.
I was going to ask you, where have you set it? Because, I mean, an Italian setting would kind of be the traditional setting.
Well, we're singing it in Italian. Yeah. I say we, I'm not singing. But we've got, it's a whole collection of Americana references. I've got Laurel and Hardy in there. I've got the preacher from The Night Hunter. We've got Abraham Lincoln. We've got Woody from Toy Story. You know, and Scarlett O'Hara, of course. Claudia's wearing these five absolutely beautiful copies of Scarlett O'Hara's dresses from Gone with the Wind. They're really they're wonderful.
With some Psycho, the film,
and
the movie,
the main piece of scenery in the show is the house from Psycho.
So we're not in any particular period in this. We are in all periods that we want to be in.
We're kind of in all periods. It's kind of late 19th century, but I'm bending the rules a little bit. And Laurel and Hardy did do a Western movie once, and that kind of got that justified them being in it. And then the Psycho House, even though Psycho was made in the 1950s, I think, the house would have been built in the late 19th century. So that's deserved its inclusion as well.
And what does the music offer you when it comes to comedy? Of course, it's all about timing and all of that type of thing. I guess the music gives you all of that without you having to feel it. Does the music suggest where the gags possibly are?
Well, that's a really good question, because actually I feel when I'm doing theatre, I have a lot more control over the pace of it. And Donizetti's idea of timing a gag is not the same as mine. And in opera, you know, you tend to repeat things over a long period. So what I do is I embellish all that with lots of gags. And I myself have got a very short attention span, so I'm never happy to just sit and watch somebody singing. Although we are letting this piece breathe, aren't we?
Yeah.
You know, but there's lots and lots of different kinds of gags and just funny business. And really, what I love about this is it really celebrates the personalities of the singers who are in it. And, you know, we've got such a great cast.
And I suppose the other side of that is, Claudia, I mean, it's hardly an outrageous thing to say that we've all been at opera buffa or comedy operas where we haven't laughed at all because it hasn't been terribly funny. Getting the comedy in opera is quite a skill.
It is, absolutely. And that's why I just wanted to give full credit to Cal, because it's hilarious, this opera. No, it is very, very funny. And I do not mind saying that at all, because I know people will laugh because I'm laughing myself. I mean, some of the things, they're very endearing. And it is a story of young love. So I think it very much suits, you know, that narrative, and the narrative of the whole opera is, I suppose, that, you know, that sincerity wins, and she picks the good guy. So it's really feel good opera, and it's a feel good piece.
And it's a farce as well, isn't it? You know, so, and that knowing you're doing a farce, and some of the music is so beautiful, and if you just go with, oh, this is a beautiful opera, you're missing out on so many opportunities.
And I guess the other aspect of that comedy aspect is, in the case of Adina, yes, she is playing a little bit, certainly with the sergeant. And it's not that she's playing with Nemorino, but she's a bit annoyed at him. And she's,
oh yeah,
she thinks that he has been messing about, and she wants him to learn a little lesson. So she's having fun with him. She's playing him
a little bit. Yeah. I mean, it's that age old saying, you know, once you don't have something, you miss it. And I think, you know, certainly in Act Two, when Nemorino does, he's surrounded by all of these women, and she's not used to it, and she does not like it. So yeah, she definitely does play up, and she wants his affections again, obviously. Yeah. But I think she's young too, and she just gets caught up in everything. I don't think there's huge malice in it, but she certainly lets herself get caught up.
Is the doctor perhaps the funniest of the characters? Of course, the biggest quack of them all, the guy who comes in with the
elixir of love. Malloy, the brilliant John Malloy playing Dr. Del Camara. And yeah, he brings so much colour and life and fun to. In fact, I've got John coming out before the show and addressing the audience. And we've cast the brilliant actor Ian O'Reilly, who was in Moon Boy years ago. And he was in my show at the Abbey Theatre in 2019 as well. And he is Dr. Del Camara's assistant. And the two of them are like Morecambe and Wise together. They're a great double act.
Yeah. Oh, so they're the warm-up comedy act at the top.
They are.
In some ways.
It's a lovely icebreaker, actually. Yeah. It's really nice just to warm up the audience, especially for a comedy.
However, we do want to hear a little bit of Adina's role before we finish up.
Yes.
Claudia, her big aria is in the second act. Big 11-12 minute aria. She goes through a lot of emotions in this particular piece.
She does indeed. And listen, Donizetti loved writing for the soprano voice, and you can tell that in his score. So yeah, this actually, we're doing an alternate version of Prendi per me, which is her original aria, and it was written, I think it was 7 years after the original.
So again, a kind of an extended version that Donizetti added in.
Yes, there was a very popular soprano, Fanny Tacchiardi, and she was proving very popular in Paris at the time, so he rewrote this aria for her, just to heighten her role towards the end of the opera.
So what is she singing about here?
Well, here she has bought the contract back from the army because Nemorino has gone and enlisted to get money to buy more love potion. You know, it's a vicious circle. But she does realise that she loves him too, and she doesn't want anything to happen to him, so she buys back his contract. And it's at this moment of the opera where they're both being completely genuine. All of the jokes have stopped. And I think that also makes this moment more powerful.
Tender.
We've had so many, you know, gags and fun, and it just makes the beauty even more ethereal and transcendent. And she says, prendi per me, sei libero. Take it from me, you are free.
Well, there you go. What a nice way to finish up. But let us listen to the Act Two aria of Adina from Donizetti's Le Lisir d'Amore. Cal and Claudia, thanks so much for coming into us this evening.
Thank you very much.
Section there of Adina's aria from Donizetti's Le Lisir d'Amore. Claudia Boyle will be playing that role at the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin from the 25th through till the 31st of May, the National Opera House in Wexford on Wednesday the 4th of June, and Cork Opera House on Saturday the 7th of June. You can find out full details at irishnationalopera.ie. Now, there must be something in the water in Manchester that turns people into poets, whether that is the poetry in motion on the Old Trafford pitch, or the poetry in music. Think of the Smiths, Joy Division to mention but two bands, or actual poets such as Carol Ann Duffy, Lem Sissay, or John Cooper Clarke, or my next guest, Mike Garry, who left his life as a librarian to become a performance poet. Delighted that Mike is with me in studio this evening. And welcome home, I suppose, I can
Thank
say,
you.
Mike.
It's very kind of
there,
you.
There is an Irish background there, isn't there?
Yeah, I spent years in the summertime, 6 weeks holidays, Easter holidays, on that B&I ferry across here and up to South Armagh, where my mother's from, or down to Kilskeer in County Meath, where my dad was from, mainly up north on the borders, to be honest. And that later developed where my auntie Maureen, 90 years old, built a bungalow where they used to go on holidays in County Louth in a small place called O'Meath.
Oh, just
next to Carlingford.
Yeah, just on the southern side of Narrow Water, as that patch of water is called there.
Months there as kids, and really important, and really important in my development as a writer and as a person, to be honest. You don't realise how important it actually is. My parents moved over to England, I think my mother was 17 or 18.
Was it the 50s when they moved over? Was it that time?
Late 50s, early 60s.
A lot of people went at that point.
And we grew up in an Irish household in Manchester. It was rosary in the evening, it was mass, it was all the iconography, it was all the culture, background, and rebel songs. So it was rich with culture. But then I'd go outside the door and I'd be in the middle of Moss Side, where it was Afro-Caribbean.
Right, yeah.
And
quite a lot of influences happening there.
Massive influences. And that's what's good about it.
You're going to perform a little ditty for me
right now.
And there's a bit of audience participation.
Yeah. What I want you to do is I want you to use your intelligence and your ability to rhyme to guess the last word of this poem. A bit of musical knowledge might be useful as well, but I just want the last word. The poem's called The Guy Who Shouted ... five letters.
Okay.
Who was that guy and what was he thinking? Was he on drugs or had he been drinking? Because to think that thought and to shout that word, had he been bought, he should do bird. Was he a Luddite in fear of progression or suffering from some dark depression? Did he think his claim was true or was his shout really meant for you? Because I've bunged my ears with carbolic soap, but I just can't stop that word echo to the very core of me very soul. I'll find a tree, I'll hang a rope, I'll start a car and attach the pipe. The word, it haunts me every single night. If I could only find that guy, I'd very simply ask him why. Did he think he was a brand new kind of Jesus sent to Manchester concert halls to save us from a Jewish kid with plugging strings still scratching round for songs to sing? I hate that guy who tried to delude us. I hate the guy who shouted.
Oh, and now you have to come up with the final word in this poem.
Audience participation, answers on the postcard.
And you've only got a few minutes to do so, so get thinking quickly.
Let's see who's smart out
there. The smartest in the house. We may or may not find out in the next 4 minutes. Tell me a little bit about, I mean, obviously that growing up and constant back and forth between Manchester and Ireland was a big part of your formation, you said, as a poet. How much do you think Irishness is responsible for what I talked about there, the football field, the music arena and the world of poetry? How much does the Irishness of Manchester, has it fed into those endeavours?
Massively, especially in Manchester. Look at the bands. There would be no Smiths. Work your way through the bands who were influenced by Irish of second generation. Catholic upbringing as well. The influence, because of their culture and their previous upbringing, our upbringings and our parents and our blood and the visiting, the back and forth, the nature of growing up in a diverse community before that word was even invented. It's enriching and it brings to the soul lots of different cultures. So it's not just the Irishness, it's the Afro-Caribbean and the Asian influence as well, because there's not a great deal of difference. All the black guys I knew drank Guinness and liked old Irish women. It was a big influence. It was a big influence in Manchester, and Manchester was enriched by it. We call it Manc Irish.
Manc Irish, right.
Because it's been so important to our upbringing. But at the same time, I didn't particularly like Irish dancing, or I didn't particularly like the fiddle or anything like that. But the fact is, it's there, and the poetry and the culture and the lyrics.
I'm astonished at the number of possible final words we have, by the way, for your poem already. But we still have a little minute left that I want to touch on. You have brought, the way you perform your poetry, there's a real performance element to it. But you have brought poetry to all sorts of places in strange ways. Prison perhaps being perhaps the most unusual, but maybe I'm wrong to say that that's an unusual place to bring poetry.
Yeah, I try to bring poetry to places that it doesn't exist, because I think lots of people miss out on poetry because our education systems alienate young people from poems. So it frightens them, so they move away. They'll talk about rap and lyrics, but they won't talk about poetry.
Yeah.
So I'll do anything I can to get it into the right people's minds.
Yeah, as you say, rap is poetry.
Exactly.
You know, so
exactly.
If we put a different name on it, give me the end line or the run into that end line again.
Did he think he was a brand new kind of Jesus sent to concert halls to save us from a young Jewish boy with plugging strings still scratching round for songs to sing? I hate the guy who tried to delude us. I hate the guy who shouted.
Judas, says Gail in Tralee. Useless, says Barbara. I don't know where Barbara is. Jurassic, says Gail in Tralee. She wants more than one go.
Gail needs to learn how to rhyme.
Judas, Derek Maloney, isn't it? Jesus, says John Sweeney. And Judas, a couple of Judases here. Hi, is the five-letter word Judas? Final word Judas? They're very clever.
Because it's a famous Bob Dylan situation where in Manchester, he plugged the guitar in at Manchester Free Trade Hall and someone shouted Judas.
Oh, because of the electrics.
And that's why, because he was turning on it. And that's when Bob Dylan turned around. Are you serious?
when will you be back, Mike? Because, I mean, you have a gig in the Workman's Club tonight, but that's the end of a long tour, I presume.
It is.
The Irish have lapped up your poetry because there's a real communicative feel to it.
Yeah, there is. There is. It's been absolutely amazing. This is our last night tonight, and we're very much looking for invites back. So if you've seen anything that we do and you're interested in, please give us a call. We love this country. We do love this country. We're not just saying that out of anything. It's an honest thing, because we genuinely believe that the Irish get it more than other people. That's why we're here.
By the way, there's still loads of Judases coming in here. And Gail has sent in an explanation. Jurassic came up on her phone because it was predictive text.
Right.
So if you try Judas, Jurassic comes up.
Switch it off, Judith.
Yeah, switch off the predictive text.
It can get you in trouble on national radio.
There you go. Well, listen, Mike, lovely, lovely.
Absolutely lovely to see you.
Thanks for coming in. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. I hope I can find some names here. Yes, I can. Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.